This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. DNA tests allow us to swab and send off our genetic material. Within a few days, find out our genetic makeup. Are you European or sub-Saharan African or maybe Native American? Now, this last category is of particular interest for many Americans. Some families have a running narrative that a member of their family was Native. But even if a genetic test confirms it, does that mean that you get to claim that you are now a member of that community? Scholar Kim Tallbear has been looking into questions of racial politics in science for years, and she has found the identity of people that they derive from DNA tests can be highly problematic. Kim's book is Native American DNA, Tribal Belonging, and the False Promise of Genetic Science. And she joins me now. Kim, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You were visiting UNC this week and have been talking about genetic tests and indigenous appropriation. Let's talk about the basics of genetic testing. What can we learn and what can't we learn from these tests?
Well, there are two, broadly speaking, kinds of DNA tests that I look at in my work and that are involved in people thinking about Native American identity. The main type of test that is often advertised, say, on Ancestry.com or by 23andMe, is what is known as a genetic ancestry test. And that's what the public is really most familiar with. And those tests are looking back to founding ancestors in the Americas, as geneticists call it. And so they're not pointing to named people that you might be related to, right? They're pointing back to, if you're looking at the maternal line, a female ancestor millennia ago, or at the paternal line, a male ancestor millennia ago. And so they can show that one has ancestry in the Americas, but they can't point to a particular tribal group. Because the markers that are called quote unquote Native American markers are found throughout the Americas, all the way from the north to the south, just in differing frequencies depending on the markers that you're looking at.
Well, let's talk about these markers for a minute because I get a little confused now and then. I am told that race is not biological, it is a social construction. And then I hear that you can find out if you are African or Native American or European, which to me are at least correlated with race. What's going on?
It's pretty complicated. And so I understand why the public hears geneticists say their race is a social construct, it's not genetic, and why it kind of looks like it's not a social construct, right? Because we get these really racially clean images in the advertising. You know, you get the prototypical African-looking person, prototypical European-looking person, et cetera. There's never racial ambiguity in the images that are used in the advertising. So geneticists will no longer really use the term race when they do their sampling and they do their science. Post-World War II and the horrors that happened in Nazi Germany, they used the word population. And there was a concerted effort to switch from race to population. And while race categories are seen as biologically distinct, historically, population is clinal. So you can look at these markers in terms of percentages. So you and I share markers in common, but I will have more quote-unquote Native American markers and you would have more, I presume, European markers just looking at you, right? But they've moved away from the idea of distinctness to think about the idea that many human beings share obviously genetic material, but we would have markers that would, some of us have more markers showing geographic origins in certain parts of the world and some people others.
So it has more to do with geographic origins. And again, if you can be located here 10,000 years ago on the North American continent, that's when we then say there must be some Native American in your ancestry.
Right. Yeah, the way that they talk about it.
Because that's the way they talk about it. But you talked about sort of these clean images, too, when we do the advertising. And yet, as I said in the intro, there are these stories that Americans like to tell, many Americans, that point back to Native American ancestry. And it's also part of the advertising. I mean, let's listen to this. I think it's a celebrity, though it's not anyone I know. But anyway, talking about her surprise finding.
I wanted to know who I am and where I came from. I did my ancestry DNA, and I couldn't wait to get my pie chart. The most shocking result was that I'm 26% Native American. I had no idea. Just to know this is what I'm made of, this is where my ancestors came from, and I absolutely want to know more about my Native American heritage. It's opened up a whole new world for me.
Discover the story only your DNA can tell. Order your kit now at AncestryDNA.com.
Right, there's a clip from an actress and former news anchor talking about Ancestry.com. I'm talking with scholar Kim Tallbear, who studies racial politics and science. And you say this is a part of what you're trying to address in your book and in your talks about this sort of claim to Native identity through DNA.
Right. So there are a couple of problems with making a claim to be Native American based on a DNA test. And those tests have some scientific problems, and then there are some social problems that are involved. But that advertisement is really interesting. Most people who take a Native American DNA test, if they don't have lived affiliations with indigenous communities, they're not going to get a percentage that high, very likely. It's a high percentage. But I did some research into that woman because I've been interviewed about that ad by the CBC too. And she actually has a Spanish last name. Well, in the United States, if you have a Spanish last name, chances are you have ancestry from south of the U.S. border. And so there's a whole lot of people in Central America and South America who have indigenous ancestry, but they don't necessarily identify as indigenous because there's more of a mestizo consciousness down there, right? It's different than the U.S. She should not be surprised. I would say that she has that high a level of indigenous ancestry. It's just that probably where her ancestors come from in Latin America, they wouldn't necessarily identify as indigenous, if that makes sense. But most Americans who do not, again, have a lived affiliation, they're not going to get a percentage that high. And so otherwise, because they would know those family members already if they had that much ancestry.
Well, and therein lies some of what you like to talk about, knowing your family members, being a member of a community, right, versus finding out that you have this connection and then suddenly claiming an identity.
Right. Yeah. So there are, I would say most people who take the test are going to get a very low percentage or none. And even if they do get a low percentage, again, it doesn't point back to a particular tribe or a particular community. And so who are you going to go claim affiliation with? What's coming into conflict here are dominant U.S. American notions of race. And race is very operative as the way that we think about who we are in the United States. But indigenous people are a little bit different. Sure, we have the category of Native American as a race category put onto us. But we also very much think in terms of our tribal identity. That's my identity as a Dakota person is much more important to me than my identity as a Native American. And that's not true for most Americans. They're much more tightly tied into the idea of race, I think, than we are.
Well, sometimes. Absolutely. And of course, the idea of blood quantum as a way of measuring your or identifying your racial category is something that was created by Americans. The idea that we're going to identify you and put you in this group based on your ancestry.
Right. And that was developed for white people's land management. Those first roles that listed blood quantum were developed in order to break up the communal tribal land base and provide homesteads and land allotments to settlers.
So, why do you think it's been so important? Because it's not just with Ancestry.com. This goes back a long way, this narrative of the Cherokee ancestor.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard it growing up, too, and people who sort of make this claim. And it seems very important to them to be able to make the claim and tell. And the story has been passed down, apparently.
No, it has. It's very common in the South. So this is interesting to me, coming from South Dakota, where there's a very much a red-white racial dividing line up there. There's natives and whites. There's not a lot of other kinds of people, or there weren't when I was growing up. So the racism towards native people was very explicit in South Dakota. And when I came east, when I moved to Boston, and then I traveled throughout the South, I was shocked to hear people say, "Oh, you're native. Oh, that's so neat. Oh, I have a Cherokee great-grandmother." You just don't hear this in South Dakota. But there are anthropologists, literary scholars, and historians that have written extensively on the claiming of Cherokee ancestry and playing Indian in the South and in the East. And so going back 400 years, you have people that are non-Indigenous who are dressing up like Indians. You had the Boston Tea Party. You have 19th century fraternal orders. You have the emergence of the Boy Scouts. It has been a very common American practice to dress up and play Indian, as Philip Deloria, who's a Dakota historian, puts it. And a lot of this has to do with wanting to claim an American identity. And you can't fully become American in this place, scholars have shown, without eliminating Indigenous people. Well, there were two ways to eliminate Indigenous people historically. We had the Indian Wars, we had massacres, or you also have this strange race dynamic in the U.S. where Black people, for example, can never become white because Blackness is dealt with differently. But red people or Native people can be whitened. And federal policy policy tried to whiten Native people. Anthropologists believe Native people could be white. And so there's a very different race dynamic happening with Indigenous people in the U.S. versus with Black people. And so this has got a lot to do with why people think that they can dress up and play Indian, they can take on mascots, they can, and it's related to claiming a Cherokee ancestor in the family. These stories have been told for centuries as people, you know, either might have real ancestry or they have a desire for that ancestry, and the stories get handed down in ways that it seems become farther and farther from the original truth.
But I do wonder about that. Where there is racial hierarchy like the United States, you can understand why people and who are not in the dominant group would want to have some claim to that group, right? You can understand why you might want to pass for white. You can understand that in a dominant group.
Yeah.
Why does the dominant group want to claim that it has Cherokee ancestry?
Well, it's pretty obvious to me. I mean, one can feel more Indigenous to this place and not feel so complicit in colonization. It seems
so. It's a way of assuaging some guilt.
But I don't think it's conscious.
Yeah.
I do believe that people like Elizabeth Warren, right, who comes from Oklahoma, Senator Warren, who made a lot of claims to being Cherokee. That's a very common story. I think people really believe it. You know, I don't think people are going around just fabricating the story. I think the untruth of what they're doing is deeply embedded in the way that Americans think about themselves for centuries. I don't think this is an individual choice to be dishonest quite often.
But talk about the importance then to you of membership, belonging to the group, meaning being a member of the community and having an identity and relationships within the community.
Right. So I think Indigenous people, Native people, have a really different definition of what constitutes kinship and belonging than Euro-Americans do or than other Americans do. And anthropologists have looked at how Americans think about kinship. It tends to be according to lineal descent from, you know, male and female ancestors. But for Indigenous people, we tend to emphasize extended family more. In my own culture, I am the mom to all of my sister's children, and my brother would be the father to his brother's children. So we have different definitions of aunt and uncle and mother and father. The grandmothers and grandparents were central in raising children. We tend to care about the tribe. In my culture, that word is Oyate. So that is a family group that matters more to us than just our nuclear family. And nuclear family, of course, was imposed on us. State-sanctioned monogamous marriage was imposed on us along with private land ownership, right? So the family went hand in hand with private property in the United States. And our definitions of family and tribe and nation were quite different. And we still try to keep those alive, even though they're very compromised by federal policy and by what the United States has put on us. So that's where you see the conflict and the tension. And people raised outside of a tribal community don't have an understanding of how we do community, how we do belonging, and how we do family. And that, to me, is a key indicator that somebody's actually not Indigenous when they come and try to become Indigenous through a DNA test, but they have this distinctly non-Indigenous definition of family and culture and race that they're using to think through the DNA testing, if that makes sense.
It does, but then it also, and you pointed to this, some of the conflicts that it creates when that culture bumps up against a different culture who has a different idea of land ownership and community relationships. And it does, particularly with federal programs, then Native recognition becomes kind of an important thing and membership in the group becomes important. And can lead to conflict when there are limited resources. And if you try to expand the group, I guess, you reduce the amount of money in a group,
right,
whatever resources each member might receive.
Yeah, tribal communities actually really struggle with changes in enrollment. And this has happened post-gaming. It's happened post-1970s with a lot of economic development on reservations around the U.S. So while we would like to enforce our own definitions of belonging according to our own cultural standards, it's just not realistic that we get full cultural power to do that, because we're dealing with a very powerful nation state. We're dealing with its politics and economy. And so what we do is we try to, I think, often combine our own sensibility about family and belonging with what's required to engage in a relationship with the federal government and with state governments. And so there's no going back to some sort of pure sense of tradition. That's just not realistic, right? And this is what we struggle with. And it's an ongoing struggle.
You gave a talk yesterday at UNC. You go around the country giving these things. And I wonder if you notice the response to your talks is different from place to place.
It is. It's been really interesting being in Chapel Hill. I've been to meetings at Eastern Band Cherokee. I've been to meetings at Duke. They do a lot of genome research there, but I've never been here. People are very polite.
Well, this is the South.
Yes. Yeah. The cultures are always really interesting to me. It's a pretty controversial talk, the one I give, where I talk about people making false claims to being Cherokee or to being Indigenous and using DNA tests. And people have talked about that as ethnic fraud. I would be jumped upon if I gave this talk out in California, for example, where people are much more vociferous in their critical engagement. But I got a lot of good questions.
Let me talk about it. So in a place like California, you just named, the folks would push back and say, no, I have every right to that. Once I've discovered this DNA test, don't tell me I can't have it.
Quite often, I think there's this bigger emphasis on kind of multicultural inclusion out there. And there does tend to be, I've found, a divide a little bit between California reservations, so Native people living on reservations, and the Native people that inhabit the academy, which people in the university there tend to come from other places quite often. And so if you're less local and you have less of a sense of the local politics around this, I think it makes for a different response. But what I found at UNC, there's a whole lot of Lumbee and Cherokee people, right, and people from other North Carolina tribes here. And so there is a real deep sense of local and regional history. And so I was talking to Lumbee and Cherokee scholars yesterday, and it was fascinating. It's very different than South Dakota in the West, right?
How so?
Very different. People have been in contact with non-Indigenous people here for much longer than we were in South Dakota, for example. And it means that you've got these entangled histories and cultures for a couple of hundred years longer. And so you can't subject Indigenous people in North Carolina, for example, to the same stereotypes you might have about the way my people look, Sioux people, right? And so you can't look at Cherokee and Lumbee and expect them to look like we do. It's ridiculous, and to act like we do. So
change some of the relationships and expectations. Yeah. Well, we've talked about appropriation, kind of biological appropriation, but let's talk about a larger subject that's been with us for a while, and that is these sort of imagery, the appropriation of imagery, team mascots, for instance, Cleveland Indians, Washington franchise. So what should we think about that?
Well, I often hear from people, we have more important things to worry about, right? Native and non-Native people say this, we've got poverty and we've got, missing and murdered Indigenous women. Why are we worried about mascots? But I talk about why these things are connected. Again, there are two ways to get rid of Native people to make a full claim to the United States. That's either through massacres and war, or it's through eliminating us in these more metaphorical ways. And you can't dress up as a Native person and appropriate that unless there are no Native people around you. It's very difficult to do. And a lot of times the people who defend their, say, wearing Redskins mascot stuff, actually, when you challenge them on that, will turn around and say, well, actually, I am Native American. It's so interesting.
So that's where we go back to this claim where I have the right to do
right.
it.
Right. They feel a right to do that.
You teach in Canada, originally from the U.S., and I wonder, we tend to talk about North America, certainly when we're talking about Indigenous people. Are there very different ideas in Canada among Europeans in Canada?
There's a lot of similarities. There are some key differences. I think because Indigenous people comprise a larger percentage of the overall population in Canada, Indigenous issues are much more at the forefront than they are in the United States. We tend to get disappeared a little bit down here. So that has been really nice for me. It's both good and bad. So the explicit racism against Indigenous people can be quite profound, particularly on the Canadian prairies. But the visibility for Indigenous issues is really an attractive thing for me. So there's much more Indigenous media up there. You will have non-Indigenous people talking about Indigenous issues in a way that when I'm in the university down here, I'm always the one that has to bring it up. So it's been, there's a lot of, just a lot of opportunity to focus on Indigenous programming up there.
Kim Tallbear is the author of Native American DNA, Tribal Belonging, and the False Promise of Genetic Science. Kim, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for being interested.
You can find links to her work and all that we talk about at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the Ladino Spanish languages converge in the music of Yasmin Levy. Stay tuned.